Hi kids, Alton Brown here. This is the Alton Brown cast, usually recording from a little padded room above my garage in Atlanta, Georgia. But today we're actually in New York City. New York City! Because I've had to come here because so many of my fascinating friends are here. Of course, they don't want to come to Atlanta. I don't know why, but I couldn't get them on the plane. Anyway, today we're going to be taking some calls. We'll be answering some email questions from our email basket at askalton@altonbrown.com. And then we're going to interview I like this guy. You know, I didn't like this guy. When I first met Jeffrey Zakarian, now Iron Chef Jeffrey Zakarian, on the Next Iron Chef competition, which was a few years ago now, I thought, oh, this guy's pretty smarmy. This guy's obnoxious and he's way too confident. And I realized, oh, he's just like me, only he's actually got a lot more talent. And it turns out he is actually a delightful guy, a very, very talented chef, a snappy dresser, a good storyteller, and I'm very happy to say that he's I can kind of count him as a friend. I think you're going to enjoy hearing our chat. So that's going to be Iron Chef Jeffrey Zakarian coming up on the show. He, of course, if you're a New Yorker, you know about his places The Lamb's Club. If I leave the D off, he gets really upset. And then, of course, now he's also doing some fabulous I can't use the word fabulous. Sorry. He's doing some awesome. No, I can't use that either. Some really tasty new restaurants on one of the Norwegian cruise lines, best ships that I think runs out to Bermuda and back. So we're going to be hearing about that today too. And I'm going to find out if he needs to write a book, and he just hasn't gotten around to it yet. He's too busy smoking cigars and stuff. So Jeffrey Zakarian coming up on the show as well. All right, let's see if anybody on the phone's got a question for me. Scott, are you there with us?
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
What's up?
Nice. I'm here in Hawaii.
Hawaii? Where in Hawaii are you?
I'm talking to you.
Which island are you
on?
Oahu. My favorite island. What's up?
I was wondering, I've been working in the school kitchen for the past few weeks, and I was wondering what are the first things that you would do to improve school lunches?
Well, for starters, I would start cooking again. I don't know how things are in the public schools there on Oahu, but there are a lot of schools in the United States where there's not a whole lot of cooking going on anymore. It's all box cutters and reheating. Tell me about the food that you're working with there.
Well, I've noticed because we actually have a lot of fresh, good ingredients, like a lot of good tomatoes and fruits and produce. They even make their own bread, whole grain good bread.
What are you complaining about? This sounds like the best school food in America. what's the problem? You got fresh baked bread, and you got great fruits and vegetables. Where are things coming up short?
Well, part of it is, of course, the kids eating it.
So what you're saying is you're getting some good product in, but you're not preparing it in such a way that's really floating the kids' boats. They're not eating the food the way you think they should. Well, a lot of times even making just small flavor adjustments or small presentation adjustments. The thing about kids is even more than regular folks, they eat with their eyes. They eat what looks good to them. So you got to think about what kids like to eat and then try to imitate that form. It's like, I may not be able to get my daughter who's 13 to eat a big pile of fresh vegetables, but I can take that exact same number of vegetables and put it on something that looks like a pizza and she'll eat it all. And what's funny is that she won't even eat all the crust, but she'll eat all the vegetables. So a lot of this is packaging. Kids aren't quite savvy enough yet to know that they're being sold to, but they do know what they like. You've got to make the food look like something that a kid wants to eat. Another thing kids like is they like having control because they don't have control over a bunch of their life. And so a lot of things that can go into a salad bar environment tend to move better than they do on a line scenario because it simply gives the kids a little bit of control.
That's good. Yeah.
Give those things a try. We've got to move on. It was very nice talking to you. Thanks for calling from all the way out in Hawaii. Lisa, you've got a question about barbecue, I believe?
Yes. Yeah.
Hi, first off, let me ask you where you are. And that's important because what you call barbecue is completely dependent upon your location. Where are you?
Charleston, West Virginia.
Okay, then we're talking about the same thing. I talk to people out west, And they think a barbecue is a thing that you grill meat on.
Well, there are people here that think that, too.
Yeah, but they're not from there. No, nobody in West Virginia would begin to believe that. You're living in a place where the only mistake they might make is mutton, which is served in some parts of West Virginia and as well as Kentucky. But I let that go because it's delicious. So what can I do for you, ma'am?
I want to know what accounts for all the different regionalities except for that obvious beef versus pork variations of barbecue.
This has confounded me as well.
Okay.
I have not been able to figure out in my copious study of barbecue and barbecue styles why we've ended up with such derisive, such different styles over a relatively small amount of ground. And I think that what it comes down to, and a couple of anthropologists that I've actually talked to who are kind of interested in this suggest, is that, you know, this is a food style that's been around for a really long time and has been cooked by a lot of people for a long time. And of course, you know, the world used to be a lot smaller, so to speak, you know, right over the holler there used to be a lot further away so that, you know, for instance, in North Carolina, you know, Western Carolina and Eastern Carolina were a really long way apart travel-wise, and that these individual styles came up out of weather concerns, out of what was being fed to pigs, and you know, just things that were available there, as well as the desires and preferences of the type of people that settled there. Remember, the South is a huge melting pot, but we didn't all settle next to each other. You know, the Irishmen tended to settle near Irish people, and the French settled near French, and so they brought those regional. You know, somebody might just kind of like sweet better than somebody likes mustard. You know, German and French immigrants, South Carolina, they brought their love for mustard, and that shows up, of course, in that very specific kind of style. So it really has to do with immigration, and then it has to do with ingredients. And the thing is that people hold those traditions so dear to them that as we became a more cosmopolitan society, as interstates were built, we didn't all just homogenize on that. And thank God for that.
What's your favorite style?
All of them. I'll be honest with you. I tend towards vinegars and mustards. I'm not a sweet barbecue kind of guy, but I'm not real big on sauces, to be really honest with you. If it's pork, I much prefer a dry rub. But if I'm going to go with sauce, I'm married to a North Carolina girl from the Piedmont. So I'm going to go with her on the vinegars. But I also like the mustard sauces a good bit. The sweet tomato based sauces, to me tend to cover up, the flavor of pork that I love so much, but that's just me. Thank you very much for the call. And I hope you enjoy your barbecue season this year. So we're going to move on to another call. And this is Zoe. Zoe, where are you calling me from, ma'am?
Champaign, Illinois. It's like 2 hours away from Chicago.
So what's your question for me, Zoe?
What is the most disgusting thing you've ever tasted ever?
I've eaten some pretty terrible things, Zoe. I have. I've had some things. I've had some things in my mouth that every cell in my brain said, spit, spit, for the love of God, spit. But I didn't. And I think it's a tie. Back in the early 1980s, long before you were born, I was in London and I found myself in a very disreputable Indian restaurant. But, I was served a curry that had lamb eyes in it. Eyes. Lamb eyes. And the lamb eyes were disgusting. Terribly. Disgusting, horribly disgusting. The other worst meal was on. I do a program called Iron Chef America. I don't know if you've seen that show, but in the very early days of Iron Chef America, we did four episodes at the very beginning of the run before we even knew we were going to make it. It was called Battle of the Masters, and one of the chefs from Japan from the original Iron Chef show, Chef Sakai, made raw trout ice cream. And that was also revolting. And in fact, as I play that over in my mind, if I had to face the raw trout ice cream and the lamb eyes again, I don't know that I wouldn't chuck down an eye to avoid eating the raw trout ice cream because it was really, really, really bad. Thanks a lot, Zoe, for giving us a call on the Alton Browncast. In case you didn't know, you're listening to the Alton Browncast. We're going to take some time for a few questions. I've been ignoring this. We do have a website, or actually an email address you can go to, askalton@altonbrown.com. And questions tend to pile up there. And I think this week we've got about 6,972 point something. So I'm just going to grab a couple of them. This is an interesting one. It comes from Jason Martin, Rochester, New York. Says he was brought up to always keep butter in the fridge and to only have it out to soften for big dinners. But this guy says he's jealous of people who have soft butter for toast or cooking. Can't you just imagine the raging jealousy of that? He says that he's found some butter bells on the net that mostly have good reviews. But what it comes down to is he wants to know if he can keep the butter out on the counter in order to keep it soft. Okay, I live in the South. And we don't keep butter, you know, out around here because it melts off onto the counter and makes a huge mess. So here's what you might want to think about doing. And I do this because, you know what, who wouldn't be jealous of somebody that had soft butter? You know, I don't want to get into a butter rage every time that I try to, you know, butter some toast. So here's the thing. If you're serious about this, okay, Jason, don't toy with me. If you're serious about this, take yourself about a pound of butter. That would be 4 sticks. Okay, soften just slightly, you know, to room temperature, barely to room temperature. Put them in a mixer. Okay, with you know a paddle, a stand mixer, paddle, and just beat the tar out of it. Get some air in it. Okay, and then take it out, put it back in something like a tub or some other kind of bowl-like device, and then re-refrigerate it. Okay, that added air is going to keep it soft, even if it is cold. So just something to think about. All right, this next question that came into Ask Elton at eltonbrown.com comes from a gentleman named Richard Harris, who is in Charleston, South Carolina, and who is employed cooking in a restaurant. And he asks a really interesting question because it involves a word that is thrown around in popular culture and certainly in food culture a little bit too much. So here, I'm going to read it. It's a little long, but I think that this is a good question. It's one of my favorites we've ever had here. He says, I'm a culinary student about to start my last semester, and I've been working in restaurants for almost 20 years. Good for you. That's great. 20 years, pretty amazing. Recently, I started working in a 5-star establishment here in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm the AM cook. I found out last week that the server calls me the chef to the guests, and this brought up my question I'd like you to answer. At what point is taking or using the title of chef appropriate? I've been told that anyone in charge of a kitchen is a chef, but to me, the title should and does mean more. Richard, I love you. Give yourself a big hug from me, but stop there, okay, just at the hugging. Chef is a word that is thrown around left and right, and I have to tell you, amongst real cooks, and I think that you certainly sound like you're one of them, it is a term that we know when is being used correctly. So here's the deal. Here's how I see it, because we got to have some rules, okay? Number one, chef as a word, as a descriptor, is a term of respect that cooks use to other cooks that they feel deserve the title, okay? And although it is, now remember, chef really just means boss, okay? So I think that one, it can be a sign of respect, okay? If I pass Jacques Pepin on the street, I'm going to say, hi, chef, okay? It's not because I work for him. It's not because he's necessarily the boss of anything, but it's because I'm a cook and know that he has, by golly, earned that title. Okay, so we got that out of the way. Guess what? That ain't you. You're not that guy yet. And you know what? I'm not that guy yet. Okay. Anybody that calls me chef, I want to say, no, don't do that. Here's the other thing though. If you are employed as a chef, in other words, if your job description says chef, either chef, executive chef, chef de cuisine, sous chef, chef is somewhere in your job description, then that is your job and you are that. Okay. You are the chef. Now, at the restaurant you are currently working, if you are simply a cook, then you're a cook, and you should be proud of being a cook, and don't go taking that title chef. But here's the sticky thing. That server is selling food, okay, and is selling an experience, and may know that in truth, okay, if you're working at Waffle House, nobody's going to come up to you and say, the chef has prepared for you today, okay? I mean, I love Waffle House as much as the next guy, but that isn't going to be something that you encounter, okay? But if, you know, you're working at an establishment with stars, okay? You know, 5-star, whatever. I didn't know there was a 5-star restaurant in South Carolina, but, well, in Charleston, I guess there are.
5-star, 4-star, 3-star, who cares? Anyway, it's a nice place. So it may be that the server there realizes, and by the way, I'd prefer to say the waiter, that saying to a customer, the chef has prepared for you, is a lot more powerful than saying the cook has prepared for you. So don't worry about what they're saying. You worry about what you would say, and you use the word correctly, and don't worry about the rest. If you want to take, you know, the server aside and say, look, I'm a little uncomfortable with you calling me chef, then do so. Use your conscience. And it sounds like you're already doing that. And I really appreciate your question. And chef is definitely a word that I would like to hear a lot less of in this culture. And by the way, most of the people that I would call chef, when you ask them what they do for a living, they say, I'm a cook. Food for thought. So this is the Alton Browncast, recording from New York City, where I've come to talk to some fine folks, including, do I have to say Iron Chef Jeffrey Zakarian? Now, technically, that's in the right. Iron Chef Jeffrey Zakarian, restaurateur chef, and now restaurateur afloat, so to speak. Thanks for being here today.
It is a pleasure.
Tell me about the boat. Tell me about – I love how
– Don't call it a boat, Alton.
I'm sorry.
I got slapped on my wrist.
Tell me about your ship.
Well, it's very – you know, this is appropriate setting. I'm looking out of a sort of a porthole in the
Maritime
Hotel.
Well, this is the old Maritime Authority building.
Yes.
So whatever that was.
After that, it was for not very nice behaved young gentlemen came here and were sort of reformed.
Reformed.
Among other things.
Yeah.
Pull that. Let's get a little
– Yeah, here we go.
Oh, smell that air.
Here,
It's this seafaring thing in me. It's coming out all of a sudden.
I'm opening the shears here
yes.
at the Maritime Hotel as we're looking out on the.
Well, that's Pier. That's 28th Street. That's the IHAC building. That's what's his name? That owns that.
I don't know who that is, but I know one thing for sure. Your ship's not going to that dock.
They no, it is further. Not. We're on Pier 55, yeah. Pier 88, which is on 55th Street.
You're north.
So we just were very happy. We got asked for Norwegian Cruise Lines to open 3 restaurants on their new ship called The Breakaway, which is it's the second largest ship ever to home port in New York. And they painted the whole thing.
The first being the Queen Mary or?
Well, no, this home ports.
Oh, home ports.
I don't know what it was, but this is the second largest ship ever. No, it's the largest ship to home port. It's the second largest ship ever being here. But at home ports, every Sunday, you can see it. It's just spectacular. And Peter Max did a drawing of the skyline of Manhattan on the boat in colors. So it's like this giant like comic strip.
When you sweet. Look on it.
It's really sweet. So we got to do 3 really groovy restaurants. So we did a very high-end luxury seafood restaurant because you know what? There is no restaurant that serves fish on the boat. It's strange, right?
It's a ship, go figure. Jeffrey.
It's a
ship. Not a boat.
Sorry,
for the love of God, get this right.
For the love of God. And so we did that, and we did a raw bar. So we do crudo and oysters. Mm-hmm. And then we do a takeout, like a clam shack. Because what they did is they stripped away some of the rooms, and they made like a gangplank walkway around the whole ship, like on Coney Island. So you
nice.
Can actually walk a boardwalk.
Walk.
And sit and have a glass of water and a glass of wine and some clams and actually, look at the sunset. You know, you could never do that on a ship. You'd have to stand
right.
while people pass you by. This way, you have these lounges and bars and restaurants that have an outside area, and it's just
that's a fantastic idea.
But you know, it's worked great, so I'm very happy. And every Sunday, I hop on and check out things and say hi to the chef. And we train the whole staff, and they're just amazing. An amazing company, really.
Where does the ship go when it leaves here?
Well, they have
under 14, its current.
They have 14 ships. So this one was launched 3 weeks ago. It goes Bermuda and back.
Okay. And that your ship, the 3 restaurants on just that ship,
yes.
not the whole line yet. I'm sure you'll take over eventually.
I would love to, actually.
Would you?
No real estate, no real estate taxes, no landlord, no investment.
Where's the down?
There's no downside.
There's got to be.
There's no downside. There really isn't. So,
well, there's got to be a downside. There's a downside to everything.
Well, I mean, you're on a ship for 7 days, and you have to figure out how to make a menu with the food you bring on a Sunday has to last to the next Saturday.
Okay.
Now, with fish, it's a bit more difficult, but the best sushi, and I serve, grade A, I serve the finest you can, fresh. A great sushi chef will actually age fresh tuna 1 week.
That is true.
So it's absolutely perfect. We work our magic. So we have these incredible ice chests. We get fish. We do freeze a couple of pieces of fish that are able to be frozen.
Sure, and a lot is.
Yes,
the Japanese
but
are very good at it.
We freeze them in sections of 2-3 portions so that as we use, we defrost.
Sure.
So it's virtually fresh, especially the shrimp. So we've had no problems. But that's a challenge. But, the galleys are great. You can get whatever you want. We use the same purveyors we use for my restaurant, Lamb's Club and National, Peerless, from all over the country.
What about the actual devices, the appliances, the galleys themselves? Yeah, are there any restrictions there?
Well, as you know, there's one restriction in a galley, and it's fire. You can't have an open flame because fire is not good on ships.
Aggressive. Hey, martinis are here.
Oh, my goodness, it's about time. As you know, we love martinis. Oh, we have olives and lemon. Very shaken, very cold, I hope. Oh, that looks fantastic. What kind of gin do we get?
Plymouth.
Shall we?
Absolutely.
May I?
I would.
Do we have a lemon or is it olives? We're going to have olives today.
We're going to have olives. I don't have a problem with that. Well, boop. Nicely done. This is a very civilized podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Jeffrey Zakarian and I are going to do what we actually do best when we're with each other, which is that we typically have martinis with each other. Back to the ship.
Oh, yes. No fire.
No fire. So are we talking induction here or?
Talking very expensive stainless steel flat top induction. That this is a kitchen that is as good as kitchens I've worked in France. I mean, they are amazing, the galleys. I mean,
well, as long as you have a good
flat
top.
You can't call it a kitchen. It's okay. A ship with a galley. You got to get used to this stuff. I'm sorry. But we were given carte blanche. We have a 750 square foot kitchen, which is gigantic in compared to like
galley.
Galley, sorry. I'm just testing you.
Ship. Boats have kitchens. Ships have galley.
They do.
Have you done the trip? You must have gone.
No,
to
I did the trip.
Back.
Yes,
you did the trip.
We did the first one.
Had you spent much time on cruise ships before?
I have never been on a cruise ship in my life.
I've never set foot.
On. As a matter of fact, I went to see the Epic, which is the largest boat ship in their cruise line.
They can't 17. Even dock it, right?
They cannot dock here.
It stays out. It's like a mothership.
And there's a 31,000 square foot kitchen. It was remarkable. They make every single thing from scratch on in this ship. Everything.
Well, that's economical when you think about the trips they're taking.
They have to kind of.
Yeah,
but
because
it makes
things go a lot.
So, I was never on one. So it was so fascinating to actually design. We designed it. We designed it in Miami. We did. You know, my wife and I helped design the front of the house. She did most of the front. We trained all the staff at the Lambs Club, every one of them. We did tastings in Miami for all the executive staff, and then we just launched the ship in Bremen, Germany.
Right, Bremen.
That's where they build them.
Right.
And they actually build them inside a building.
Really? Well, yeah, like a big hangar over the water.
A big hangar.
Sure. Yeah.
And
they would have to for what?
And then they open the door and they flood the building. And the ship goes up.
Sure, the ship goes up and out it goes.
But to see it is just.
Oh, did you saw it?
I saw the film of the flooding of the flood, and it's remarkable. Then it goes to another port to get outfitted.
Right.
So it's been a fascinating experience, really fascinating.
If I know you at all, I mean, I won't pretend to know you incredibly well, but I would imagine that part of what you were trying to do with this project was capture. Let's face it, cruises have lost the elegance that was once implicit with an ocean crossing. We're not a very stylish culture anymore.
Why not?
I know that you and I have had many conversations about men's clothing and men's dressing habits. I imagine that part of what you were trying to do here was to bring back some real class to the on the water eating situation because it's been lost.
I try to do that in every part of my life, and not because it's better or anything like that. That's silly. I just always believe that I think we should always look at culture and try to go up versus go down. And I think our whole culture is just like slip sliding away in some profound ways. And, you know, I tell people, you know, dress for the job you want, not the job you have. And I firmly believe that in our culture as well. So I was just trying to do things, bring things really great quality, great style. And people are attracted to that. I tell you, people are attracted to that. And, you know, they will get dressed up. You don't have to have a dress code to dress people up. You just act nice and act classy and act stylish and act have a little verve in life. And they will try to like kind of emulate it. And that's what, you know, I think especially the younger generation, they've never seen this kind of thing.
No.
You know, they've only seen like, you know, they don't know who Frank Sinatra was. They don't know what the Rat Pack was. It's not that it was better. But
and I feel sorry for you kids.
A certain like, you know, joie de vivre and a certain like buttoned up fun to it. It wasn't at all. Those guys were cool cats. They had a blast, trust me.
When I was a kid, the very early days of my life were spent in Los Angeles and in Hollywood. And my
lucky
parents, because of my father's job at NBC, was an account executive, got to hobnob with people of renown and style. I, for instance, remember the laughter of the Gabor sisters pretty well in the living room because he got to hang out with people. And my parents were great entertainers. And I remember
literally I would get down. I was too young to really kind of enjoy this, but I would get down on the floor of my bedroom right at the crack of the door and listen to the sound of laughing women and cocktail shakers, and I could smell cigarette smoke, and I thought, adulthood is going to be so much fun. You know, and there was, you know, Bossa Nova playing on the hi-fi.
Better, right? On the hi-fi.
Absolutely. And you know what? Adulthood didn't really pan out quite that way. You know, we did, I don't know what happened to adulthood. I was on a flight coming back from Los Angeles last week, and the guy that got on the plane next to me was wearing gym shorts and flip-flops.
What is it about a plane that induces your brain to be soft?
I don't know. No, because when I was a kid and we got on planes, you wore a freaking suit.
I wear a suit when I fly.
I wear a suit when I fly, exclusively. But it's not because I want to be superior.
Of course not.
It's because, first off, I don't look good in gym shorts and flip-flops. I'm not sure, by the way, that anybody looks good in flip-flops. Some people look good in gym shorts, but I don't think that's the place for it.
You so hit it right on the head. It's just like being appropriate. And I think, I mean, it's okay to be casual, but how about be casual and like smart? You know, casual and smart is okay.
Where did we go wrong?
I don't know.
Because we did it with food too.
We did it with hospitality. 2 minute meals, 60 second meals. I'm like, I'm telling people, I need something quick and fun and fast to eat. I'm like, you know what? Go order something. At the end of the day, you got to put some effort. It has to be effort.
I saw you make a souffle in, what, 15 minutes? Mm-hmm. What was it? No, it was less than that, maybe. Well, don't tell me that you don't know about fast food.
I do.
Okay? Because I saw you do it.
I do, but that's like, I've been doing that my whole life, so that's a souffle. But what people say, I want something fast and quick and easy. I'm like, well, I said order out. Because at the end of the day, if you're not willing to put some work into something, and there's a whole other side to me, to food. It's like there's a family. I mean, it's okay. You're not just eating because you're hungry. You're eating because it's an act. It's breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day of your life. There's a chance to say something and do something different and enjoy something and share something with someone.
That's hospitality.
Yes.
Hospitality is not the food. It's the act of sharing something you made with someone else.
But it happens at home. We lost that at home because the moms don't cook anymore. The dads don't cook. The two-job thing really killed it. And so we started doing just takeaway and fast stuff. And then that precious time with the family left. So
are we getting it back, do you think, as a culture?
I certainly hope so, because every study has shown, like, you spend time, you eat together, you stay together. And that just happens. Two-parent family, it works. I mean, the whole dropout rate is if you get to the age of 21, you stay, you're not married, you finish high school, you get to 21, you don't have a kid until you have a job and you're married, the chances of your being dependent on welfare or food stamps drops to almost like zero.
Way down.
So there's a cultural reason that everybody, Democrat or Republican, has to sort of like accept this is, you know, you have to like take care of yourself and like make sure you're doing the right thing for your family. Mm-hmm. We've lost that sort of family practice of like taking care and having dinner and lunch and breakfast, even though if it might be a boring situation. Those moments are what people mimic. The children mimic that with their families and their families. And that's what's really
important. It's
learned behavior, but it's really great behavior. So backtracking to our conversation about quick and fast and everything, it's like you sit around the table, you go to Europe, you know, put the peas on the table, you all shuck the peas, and you make a pea salad. It's simple, but it's about sharing that experience that we've sort of lost. I hope it gets back to that. I really do.
I mean, you have that in your family. You came from a very strong Middle Eastern background.
We had breakfast together. We had lunch together. We had dinner. And
what was breakfast? When you were a kid, what was breakfast?
We had Syrian bread with za'atar and butter and scrambled eggs with lamb and, you know, like, I'm telling you, peasant food. We were very, very poor.
All my you have mother, to say is za'atar in my mouth waters, though, because
we had nothing, zero. My mother would make stuff out of nothing.
Tell people what za'atar is, because people
don't
know.
It's a Middle Eastern spice. It's you know, there's a lot of things in there's a lot of za'atars. It's almost like when you're making a what's the base of all Indian cooking.
Not a curry, but the one that means spice of the
garam
house.
Garam masala. The house.
It's garam masala. Yeah,
it's all garam masala. Right. So it's
everybody's lemony. Got a different one.
Yeah, and it's basically a very lemony. The basic herb is there's a lemon balm or zest to it, but there's also a thyme, dried rosemary, but it's very acidic on spicy. and you put it on like cracked Syrian bread that you butter under the grill, mm-hmm. and you serve it with scrambled eggs. We grind lamb and we just saute the lamb. Very inexpensive lamb. We saute the lamb. It's almost like
what cut are we
meat.
Talking here?
Just leg, anything.
Just any chunk of lamb that you can grind.
Cumin. Some allspice.
My favorite spice of all time, by the way.
A little lemon juice. You saute that and you add the eggs to that and you scramble the eggs with that and you put it on a toast with za'atar and butter. I'm telling you, you're right. You're watering like I am.
Breakfast, it's my favorite meal to cook, and I'll tell you why. Because I never bring the rest of the day to it. I get up and I'm sorry, I'm making this about me, but I get up early because I made a policy. If I'm home, because I'm not always home, my daughter is going to have cooked breakfast from my hands.
Every day.
And my wife. Every day. That is my job. And I have to tell you that getting up in the morning, fresh, clear, relatively speaking, and going into the kitchen in my freaking pajamas and making breakfast, brewing coffee and making breakfast is the most fun I will have making a meal because I'm free of all the rest of everything.
But you touched on just what makes the culture change. It's that you're taking something and you're making it a daily chore, but it's not really a chore. It's like it's a ritual.
No,
ritual
it is a ritual,
and that's what's important, and that's what we've missed. And the rituals bring depth. You don't know. You'll strike up a conversation over a ritual as a meal. You might not know. You know, as humans, we have breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. What do we do other than that? We have lunch. We meet someone. We have a date. We break up. We fall in love. We get divorced. We do everything around food. And
this, we're sitting here talking.
Exactly. So it's like it's not just for feeding your face, and that's the problem of our culture.
Do we just feed our face now?
We just feed our face. Michael Pollan said a really great thing when asked.
Michael Pollan, of course, the writer of
amazing,
course,
amazingly,
it's amazing just, thinker about food.
Great thinker. Most of all, he's a great thinker.
He is.
And, you know, he was thunderstruck, but he said, someone said, like, so what am I going to do? We're getting fatter. Everybody's eating fast food. What's the thing we have to do as adults? Is there a quick fix? He says, there's really not a quick fix. It's just, he says, at the end of the day, if you can, if you want it, whatever you want, make it.
Cook it.
And cook it.
Cook.
You want a cheeseburger?
Cook it.
Make it. You want a sundae? Make the ice cream and eat it. At least you'll be eating ingredients. You'll know the work involved. You'll have a familial sort of cultural that transition period into like spending time with somebody because it takes time. And most of all, you'll figure out you'll like something, you won't like something. You'll learn something about just making it. So he said, eat what you want, just cook it. You want French fries? Make them. Don't go and get them at a fast food place.
I recently gave a
speech.
And
I thought that was a great
advice. Oh, it's fantastic.
It's a great advice.
It's fantastic advice. I just gave a speech at a large convention. They asked me to talk about the effects of food television shows on culture. And one of the statistics that I ran across while I was working on my speech was the fact that cultures that cook at home the most stay thinner and healthier longer.
Absolutely.
There is a direct correlation between cooking at home and health. And, of course, that sounds like voodoo because you can't answer. Okay, if I make – okay, I'm going to have French fries. Mm-hmm. I have decided on French fries. Okay, I can go to restaurant La 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 and drive through and have some French fries. Or I can make my French fries. What's the difference? Well, calorically, maybe nothing. Maybe. And so I started trying to figure out, well, what's the difference? And I've come to the conclusion that there's something that either happens in the brain or in the digestive system that starts at a different rate when you're making it. There's something actually physically different about the digestive process when you prepare the food. There has to be, because there's no other explanation for it. I mean, I can go buy a hamburger at one of 15 gajillion places on planet Earth, or I can make one. Mm-hmm.
I would say that in both cases, Alton, if I may interrupt.
No.
I would say that the French fry, if you made French fries, you would probably get a smaller portion at home just because the work involved in cutting and shearing and soaking the potatoes, you would probably serve yourself without knowing it an ounce and a half or 2 ounces less.
And you would reach, here's my hypothesis, and if I can find somebody to give me grant money for this, I'll prove it. For humans to be sated, to be satisfied, if I go to a drive-thru, it takes more of something to satisfy me.
Absolutely.
If I make it myself, the satisfaction begins earlier. It begins, in fact, the moment I touch the food.
And we're not even talking about what that does to your family and the people around you and the interaction you might find. People don't talk about it. They talk about eating as like it's like this otherworldly thing. It's this
or an isolated activity.
It's a sexy thing. Eating is like you're sharing. You're putting – I'm cooking for you. You're putting food in your mouth that I cook for you. That to me is like – is that intimate or what?
Yeah. Have you always thought about this stuff this way?
No, I'm romantic, so maybe I have, and I just verbalized it now. But I, you know, to me, I look at this world like Woody Allen looks at it. I'm a hopeless romantic. I'm not a downer like Woody was, but you know, he's a bit like, you know, life is the horrible and the miserable.
Well, look at him. I'd be a downer too.
He did pretty good, though, by the way.
He did okay.
He's a bit of a freak.
A little bit of a freak.
The last turn was not good.
No, that was a bad turn, yeah.
You know, but the horrible, like he said, life is between the horrible and the miserable. And the horrible, like the people that walk around, they're blind and they're crippled and every day is something. And he said the miserable is everybody else.
Everybody else.
So just wake up one day and thank God you're just part of the miserable.
And not...
There's something uncannily accurate about that.
And you start talking like Woody when you do that. You did your hand thing.
Woody Allen used to come 3 times a week to Le Cirque on 65th Street.
Tell me about that.
Oh, my God.
All right, because I want to preface this, because this is fascinating. You were, for those of you out there listening that don't know Le Cirque was one of the anchors of New York cuisine, probably at the era of Russian Tea House and Elaine's and places like that. I mean, but Le Cirque was the high flagship.
It opened in, I believe it was 74. Ciro Maccioni opened it at 65th and Park.
And Park.
Where
fantastic
Danielle
location.
Is now.
Where Danielle is now.
Okay.
Danielle Boulud's place.
So I had the opportunity, I had the very big privilege of graduating from CIA in 1981. And the day next day, I went to Le Cirque and got a job.
When that happened, by the way?
I was old. I was 24. I mean, I was old because I was...
Compared to the rest of your
compared
class.
To the rest, because I was an economics major. So I was trying to get an MBA from the University of Chicago.
At the same time.
At the same time, I dropped out and I decided to be a chef. Didn't go over well in the old household.
What was the pivotal event that made you decide?
I went to Paris. I had a meal.
Where?
I had a meal at a restaurant called Vivre Roi.
Okay, I don't know.
Vivre Roi was a three-star Michelin restaurant in Paris. I had lunch alone with a half bottle of Chablis.
And a good Chablis, by
a really good Chablis. It wasn't that expensive. And this was 1981. This was 10 francs back then to the dollar, which was nothing. I mean, it was a high time. Mitterrand was getting elected. There was rioting in the streets. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was just having lunch. And the chef, Claude Perrault, came out in his white jacket, white starched, perfect, perfection. Everything was perfection on him. Hat, thin, like tan, gray hair, slicked back. His wife, Claudine.
Of course.
Blonde, Chanel. Like, I don't know what she was wearing on her feet, but it was like Hollywood. I was like, I want this, that moment. And I had a four-course lunch, five courses, I don't know what happened. And I remember I had this interlude of quatre poissons, which is an interlude of four poissons. I didn't know what the hell that meant, but it was four fish done differently.
Yeah.
And I was it. That was the moment I just said, I'm doing this for my life's work. That's it.
How much were you seduced by the food, and how much were you seduced by the life?
The life was way more than the food.
Yeah. So what brought you to Paris in the first place?
Because you said you're
alone.
Yes, I left.
What are you doing there?
I left college. I graduated, and I didn't know what I wanted to
do. Okay, so you've got an economics degree, which, by the way, is boring, Jeffrey.
Boring as shit.
I cannot imagine you as an economist.
I know. I can't either. But I loved politics. I loved the machination of the way things worked.
By the way, I don't know why more martinis haven't shown up.
I don't either. Now we're getting a good interview. So I told my professor at the time, Dr. Harold Langlois.
What was that? You dropped that name like it means something.
No, it doesn't, but he was the guy that was advising me.
Okay.
And he said, why don't you just go and take a 6-month sabbatical?
Blow off.
I borrowed money. I borrowed $3,000.
From who?
Student loan program.
Wait a second. Are you telling me that the student
program
gave you money to go bum around Paris?
He wrote me in I was supposed to go to the south of France and study gambling from 1855 to present.
Oh, I like that too.
Which is when it started. The English came down. They made the railroad.
This was about you wanting to go to Monte Carlo.
Absolutely.
So you already knew you wanted to go to Monte Carlo.
I wanted to go. So we made up like this paper. I actually wrote the paper. And I got the grant to go. And that's I decided to blow the grant on 3-star restaurants.
You are my hero. I just want to say that. Anybody that can decide, I want to go to Monte Carlo, I'm going to find a way to get money for it. It doesn't include work.
It doesn't include work.
But you didn't get – did you get to Monte Carlo?
I got to Monte Carlo. I actually went and gambled at the hotel casino and won $15,000.
No.
Yes. Not. I've never
gambled
in my
life. Playing what?
Blackjack. No, no. Roulette.
Okay, because I was about to say nobody wins $15,000 at blackjack.
And I walked out. I rented a tux. I walked in. I played roulette.
You rented? I want to have it on record that Jeffrey Zakarian rented a tux.
Yeah, back then I couldn't afford it to buy one.
So, but you knew that you had to be dressed properly. Well, back then you couldn't get into the casino.
No. I had to wear a tux because James Bond would never go into a casino without a tux. And he said that in one of his movies.
Or a dinner suit.
So you had to, I mean, it was a very fancy place. So anyways, and I spent every dollar of that dining in all the restaurants from Nice, Bordeaux, up to Lyon, up to Paris, and back down. I did 18 of 21 3-star restaurants.
How did you travel? By what means?
Rail, SNCF. I had one of those student pass. Very cheap. I think it was $199 for a year.
Yeah.
You could travel wherever you want.
Yeah.
So it was incredible. I had one suit. I ate lunch only. I didn't eat dinner because dinner was too expensive.
You had one suit.
Yes.
Let's talk about the suit.
Helen Bilzerian.
What color?
Beige.
Really?
Silk.
So it was summer.
Yes. Silk with, I had 4 or 5 ties.
How did you
white
know?
Shirt.
Okay. How old were you?
I was 21.
What year is this? I'm not trying to date you, but it's important in the scheme of things.
Mid around 1979, 80.
Okay. Let me just say that the fact that you're even aware of owning a tie at that age, at that time, is an anomaly.
I was kind of a freak.
Culturally, it's an anomaly. So you were already, it's 1979. I graduated from high school in 1979 and didn't own a suit at the time. things came to me later.
And they came in big. Came big to you.
What at that point in your life moved you towards a sartorial distinction?
My dad was a musician, a music teacher.
That he was a jazz musician?
Yes.
Because jazz has always known how to dress.
Yes. This dude dressed a suit and tie for breakfast.
What did he play?
Trombone.
Nice.
Suit and tie for breakfast. I never saw him undressed. I never saw him in a t-shirt. He wouldn't wear a shirt that went over his head. He always buttoned up a shirt. You give him a t-shirt, he wouldn't put it on. He once never had jeans, never. So I didn't know what this meant. I was like, whatever. I mean, but that's how I thought all dads dressed. So my dad dressed. So I, to this day, people ask me, why do you dress like that? I'm like, because my dad.
But most kids revolt against what their dads do and go with the zig-eyed at the time, which was, you know, Led Zeppelin tour t-shirts and
jeans. I love Led Zeppelin. I loved Aerosmith.
Didn't wear suits.
They didn't wear suits, but I mean, I just love that whole life. I love the lifestyle. The whole gestalt of that just moved me. And when I saw that guy and his wife in Paris in that restaurant, I was like, you know, this is not a bad thing. It's Broadway, but it's also like food, and I love food. So, you know, that was it. And I came back. I went to CIA. I asked to get into the CIA. I kept a journal of all the restaurants I ate in. And they said, it's a 2-year wait list. And I'm like, why is it a 2-year wait list? Well, they said, well, you know, we have a lot. I said, look, I've eaten at more 3-star restaurants than anybody here on the faculty has ever eaten about, and I've written about them. You tell me you don't want me here? And they were very taken aback by that.
As well they should be.
Yes.
So they let you in.
They let me in. And the day after I graduated, it was Le Cirque, and then it was like a complete...
You went straight to Le Cirque.
Straight to Le Cirque. It was the best.
Wow.
It was the best. I walked in, I said, I want a job. He said, we don't have a job. I'm like, I'll work for nothing. He goes, come tomorrow. And I work for nothing.
And
do that today, by the way, because of labor laws.
No, labor laws don't allow, which is a real blow.
It's a real blow.
What
they should have apprenticeships. If they're going to do something, at least have an apprenticeship system where, like, you get $5 an hour, just like some nominal.
A stipend.
Right? A stipend. Like, you get $700 a month or something. But have this ability to, like, suck the brains of all these great chefs or great artisans or great leather makers or great furniture makers.
Whoever
great,
it is.
Everybody. I mean, this is crazy. And I worked so hard at
that
restaurant.
What was the first day like? I know you remember it.
Yeah, I know.
Day one, Le Cirque. You walk in.
Nervous.
But you're not showing
I'll tell you the nerves I had. It was like the nerves at Next Iron Chef. Like, this is it. And I didn't know.
Because you'd eaten at Le Cirque.
Yes.
You knew what you were getting into.
But I know this is it. And I was like, working here would be like just unbelievable. And believe me, first of all, I'm working here. I'm worried about getting in and working, but I'm not getting paid. So the last thing on my mind, which is very different than what people I know in this day and age have on their mind, like today they're worried about their pension. So I'm like, I'm so thrilled that I'm here. And someone's actually offered me a job to work for nothing. But I looked around and I saw ovoli mushrooms, soft-shell crab, white truffles, white asparagus. It was like Disneyland of food. I was nervous, but I was like, I was high. It was like a high I can't imagine that I'd have again.
What was the job? What did they give you day one to do? What did you do?
Well, you know what you do. You just go in the corner and you do menial work. You pull crab tails out. You clean crabs. You clean soft-shell crab.
That's not menial.
Well, that's tough.
I mean, it's menial, but it's skilled.
It's skill, but I mean, it's like you're peeling potatoes, peeling carrots, all the stuff that it's sort of it's not a torn on position. It's almost a dishwasher position, a plongeoir. But I was like this, and I was like, you know, watching. I'm watching that guy. I'm like, I'll have his job in 2 weeks. I'm going to have his job in a month. I'm going to do that in 6 weeks. I knew it.
Did you literally? And did you stick to that schedule?
Oh, absolutely.
Confidence has never been a real problem for you.
No, because I'm a good mimic. I'm a mimic. I know how to like mimic things. So if I don't have the talent, I can mimic the talent until I get the talent, hopefully.
Well, isn't part of getting talent doing talent? I mean,
yeah,
you get it.
You get it. But there's also a way to mimic it so that I can do this a little quicker than normal and I'll make it happen faster.
So it was important to you to move quickly.
Move quickly, very quickly.
Why? Why did you want
to
move
so fast?
I
always feel behind. I always feel like I got to get this done. I don't know. It's just the way I am. I saw people do things. I'm like, well, if he just came early, he could get this done. That was my thought process. Like, get your ass in earlier. You get it done. Why are you behind? I'm like, I can't finish this. And I didn't. These people are above me. I'm like, you didn't finish it because you didn't get here early enough.
Yeah, but you're talking about a culture, as you well know, that's based on your shift starts at 4, you get here at 1.
Yeah, back then it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that. But there were some people that like were laggards and they would just hang around and like do what they wanted to do. But I was like, no.
At Le Cirque.
So my shift started at 7 in the morning. I got there at 5:30. And the sous chef saw me. He goes, what are you doing here? I'm like, I want to get ready. I'm going to get ready. You don't have to be here real early. He says, go sleep. I'm like, no, I want to be here. But you know what? That word got around.
Yeah,
the chef heard. Yeah. Alan Syek.
Securian's coming in early.
Exactly. You know what they did? They gave me more stuff to do.
Yeah, they did.
You want to get something done, you give it to the busiest person. You don't give it to the person that doesn't have anything to do. You give it to the busiest person. Yep. I was the busiest person.
So you made it your mission to be the busy guy.
Absolutely.
Tell me about moving to the souffle station, as it
Fernando.
Were.
Fernando.
Not that there was a station. Was there actually a station for souffle?
Oh, my God, yes.
Okay. Because that was a big deal at the Cirque.
Which I want to single-handedly bring back. Souffles at restaurants.
Good for you. I'm all for it.
We had souffles for 2, for 4, for 6, for 8. And 8 was like, you know, 14-inch thing.
Yeah, that's a major souffle.
And they were perfect. Alton, they were like 7 inches above the rim. Perfect. They go out to the table. People are like, oh, my God. It cost like about $1 for a souffle for 8. We charged $6 a person, which back then was like a lot of money. And the gentleman named Fernando, who is the assistant to Didier Schorner, who invented the Four Seasons cake.
Very famous cake.
And the creme brulee. That was the guy.
No,
who, yes,
really?
Yes, 1981.
Wow.
And Fernando, a little Mexican kid who did all the souffles. He was amazing, by the way. Guy had a beaming smile on his face all the time because he knew he had a job. Basically, he had a job for life because he did 100, 120 souffles a night. That's what we did then. He was making sugar, soft crack sugar. He spilled it on his hand. And you're in 212 plus degrees, and his hand blew up like an elephant. It was awful. Went to the hospital, and Alan Sykes said, he was French, didn't speak any. Geoffrey, you do souffle now. Go over there. Go over there now. That was it. So I spent a year over there.
Had you already mimicked enough?
No. Never saw the station. I worked at theater the first night. It was like a disaster. It was like really hard. He worked with me, showed me everything, showed me the souffle, showed me the appareils. We made all the souffles ahead of time. We put them in souffle molds. We buttered, sugared them, put them in molds, put them in the fridge. We took them out of the fridge and baked them to order.
Do you still do that? Is that your method today?
Yeah, I mean,
because that does stabilize in the temperature.
But you know what? This whole thing, it takes
range.
20 minutes to cook a souffle. You got to order ahead, which I hate ordering dessert, by the way, when you sit down.
How long would they hold?
Well, they would never hold more than that. Whatever we had in the refrigerator was gone by the end of the night. So we never had a whole. We throw out once in a while. What are you throwing out there? You're throwing out
some eggs.
Eggs. A little panade. It's like nothing. So we had a souffle menu. A souffle menu. And it was, I mean, it was amazing. And so to this day, I am supremely confident in making a souffle.
Why is it that to the American home cook, the souffle is the demon dessert, the killer of dreams? Why is it so freaking difficult for people?
Well, you've done a lot of stuff on your shows about demystifying things.
You tried. Yeah.
And sometimes things just can't be demystified. And I think a souffle is one of those things. And I think that people get messed up with the things about a souffle that work. You got to beat the egg whites enough. You have to have them high enough, and they have to be stiff enough. The oven has to be...
But not too stiff, or there's no expansion. No.
The oven has to be hot enough, and you have to let them cook. The souffle cooks in the last 20% of the time, it rises. So people get freaked out when they look at it in their glass
and it's
door.
Up.
It's not quite up yet, and it's like, oh, it's at 15 minutes, and it's 13, and it's not there yet. And like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And then they take it out, and it goes down. Instead of you leave it alone, the last 45 seconds, that last middle bit that's wet makes everything come out. And so people are just impatient. And I think our ADD has something to do with the culture.
The secret to a souffle is patience.
Patience. Of course, you got to have the thing buttered correctly. You have to have the appareil made correctly. It can't be too heavy. It can't be too wet. It has to be. But those are. Everybody's trying to make a quick souffle and a quick, fun souffle. And they're not putting panade and not putting bechamel. I mean, there's a lot of ways to make it. I mean.
What do you prefer?
I prefer, you need eggs. You need egg yolks.
Yes, by definition.
By egg yolks. You don't necessarily need flour. A little flour is okay if you're making a savory souffle, like for a cheese souffle or something that has to carry a bit of weight. You need
because you're going to make a bechamel.
You need a bit of flour. You need a bit of flour. So, you know, the whole fallen souffle, chocolate souffle, Jean-Georges thing, which is actually not Jean-Georges. It's really a gentleman in France named – I'm going to think of it in a second.
We'll come back to it.
We'll come back to that.
But Jean-Georges took it.
He took it. And it's basically, 6 ounces of sugar, 6 egg yolks, some egg whites, and some 6 ounces of butter.
Some egg whites?
6 egg whites.
6, okay. There you go.
And you know, it can be off or on because at the end of the day, it's undercooked. So you flip it out. So it doesn't have to ride. It's a souffle cake.
Right. Which is very forgiving.
It's very forgiving. Does it taste, yes, great? Yes. So, but is it a souffle?
Textures,
no.
No. It's a souffle omelet.
So that was my first job. I had that for a year.
You became the master of the souffle.
I did. I did. For no other reason became I had to. I had to. I had no choice.
So
an amazing place to start. By the way, I lost a year on the other dudes that are running around in the kitchen.
Because you were the souffle guy.
Because I'm the souffle guy.
So once a year came up, you're feeling what? Bitter? You're feeling this is not working for me? I'm stuck in souffle?
Well, it was so fantastic. And I was like, this is great. I'm in Le Cirque and whatever. So when I moved to the hotline, it was tough. I was working next to David Boulay, Terrence Brennan.
Big names.
Rick Moonen.
Rick, really?
I mean, this is the line. It was like a bunch of, they were like tough. They were like, get out of my way, kid.
I'm going to eat you alive.
I'm going to eat you alive. But, you know.
You wouldn't have that. So who did you mimic? Who did you mimic on that?
I'll tell you who I mimicked. It's a good question. Rick Moonen.
Yeah. Sure you would.
Rick Moonen.
Because his technique was the cleanest.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. He showed me how to set up a kitchen.
The whole thing. The whole line.
This guy went to the bathroom by a clock. He was like, it was amazing. It was like army time. He would have his pots and pans at 6 o'clock. He would have his water would be boiling at 6:15. His eggs would be like room temperature at 6:30. The sabayons would be done by 7. The wines would be uncorked by 7:15. The reductions would be done by 7:20. I mean, it was unbelievable. He had a clock. He had a pad. He crossed things out every day. I mean, every day, Alton. Every day. Even when we knew it, every day.
No, you do the list. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I did work that 2-3 guys can't do today with that list. I watched him. I was like, wow. And then he banged out 200 covers of lunch. Woody. Kissinger. all these people. I mean, amazing.
Pow, 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 pow.
Big stuff, big stuff. So, and that's in the days, the pre-foam, pre-rationale.
Yeah, that was just food.
Bagged, pre-
pre-sous vide.
Cryovac. No, there was no sous vide.
There's no sous vide.
Everything, Jose, roasting, everything in butter, roasted, everything. Real steamy, steamy, steamy in the steamer, yeah. You want a puree thing, you had a buffalo chopper. Puree soup in a thing? No, no. You put in a buffalo chop, you put in a giant Cuisinart or a giant Robocoup.
Are you serious?
And you just strain it and pass it. I mean, it was rigorous. But you know what? You learned a craft that no one's teaching anymore.
Why aren't they?
Well, because basically, you know, time is money. Cooks are more expensive.
Real cooks.
Real cooks. It doesn't mean there aren't great real cooks. Like Justin's a great real cook. You know, there's some theorist people out there.
Different kind of cooks.
Different though. Kinds, but you know.
Not passing down a heritage no. of a skill set.
But, you know, all the tools and all the mechanicals and technology that's available to me today, I use. Because I know I have to be competitive. But I don't lose that joie de vivre, that style, that zeitgeist, that flavor, that Michael uses, that these chefs use, that really know what it tastes, what yummy means. Because yummy means butter, caramel, roasting, direct heat. And you got to do that a lot for it to be second nature.
What do you think you pass on most to your cooks?
What do I pass on?
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Because you are now, you're a father of cooks.
You know, it's weird. I think of that. It's like, hopefully, I want to make them, this is going to sound strange, I want them to have fun.
Fun's good.
I want to enjoy this. I mean, it should be like a hobby that's your career, not a career that you got to do, then you go home and get away from it. I don't want these guys to get away from it. Like, it's not get away from, you can't get away from cooking. You can't get away from running a restaurant. It is what it is. You take it home, you got to love taking it home. It's just the way it is. If you want to not take something home, be an accountant. There's nothing wrong with that, by the way. You know, do something that at 9 to 5, you punch out, you're done. But if you want to be in the restaurant business, you have to take it home and you have to love it. It has to be something that, like, you know what am I doing to my night off? Where are we going to go? Where's a new restaurant? I want to go to the new restaurant. Come on with me. Two guys that are off. Let's go. Let's go to the new restaurant together. Let's learn some stuff. Let's have fun. That's the business we're in.
What led you into the Next Iron Chef competition?
I got
fun.
You
got some bad information, buddy, because that wasn't fun.
It was not fun.
I didn't see you have a lot of fun on it.
I started to have fun about Montauk.
Montauk, for those of you listening, was really close to the end.
Yeah, it was really close to the end. Actually, I had fun when I almost got eliminated with Bo. My attitude was like, it doesn't really matter, because I was generally a happy person, and I had a good life, and I had great restaurants, and
You decided to throw yourself into.
I did, you
a
know.
Storm. Why did you do that?
Scott Feldman, my agent, said, "Listen, I put you up for the next Iron Chef. What they call it? Super Chef? What was it called?
It was the Super Chef.
Some silly thing.
It was Super Chef.
But they were really great chefs. It was Michael and Marcus and all these guys. And all these guys, other than like sort of the only contemporary there was Michael Chiarella. Because age-wise. Yeah. But Marcus and all these guys are real friends of mine. And some unknowns like Spike and
Spike Mendelsohn.
Yeah, and Bo and these guys.
Bo McMillan.
But it was – and Alex, it was 10 like amazing, really and amazing chefs. And I said
– Elizabeth Faulkner.
Yeah, really.
Out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere. And I said, Scott, I said, what do you think? He said, I think you should do it. I said, why? I said, it's you. It's like it's your time. He said, it's your time. This is for you. I said, you'll do great in this competition because it's not just about cooking. I'm like, okay. So, real story.
If it's not just about cooking, what
it's
is
not,
it?
No.
What's it about?
He said it's not. He said it's about like telling a story. And he said, like, there's a lot more than just cooking. There's a lot of chefs that make it like they get by because they tell a great story. And that might their story might be a slightly bit better than the food they served, but it works. And it's a human thing. You have judges that are actually human beings judging you. So I said, okay, whatever. So what does it entail? I said, we have to go to Los Angeles, 2 weeks, 3 weeks on the road. I'm like, what do you mean? I have to be away from my family for 3 weeks? He said, yes. I said, I don't want it. I said, turn it down. He said, what do you mean? I said, like, I don't want to be away from my kids for 2 weeks. It's like, it doesn't work for me. And wisely, he said, no, this is an amazing opportunity. You got to do it. I said, listen, I'm going to think about it, but I really think it's not the right thing for me. I hate being away from my family. And so my unbeknownst to me, he called my wife. He said, listen, I got him on Iron Chef. It's a yes, but he said he doesn't want to do it because he wanted to be away from me. She said to him, I'll take care of it. My wife called me Not 3 minutes later, she said, "You're going." Just like that.
Yes, dear.
In those words.
Yes,
I'm like, "Are you sure?" She said, "You're going. We'll be fine. We'll come out and visit you." And that was it.
Because you have a wife and two daughters.
Yeah.
And really young daughters.
Really young daughters at that time. And they were great. They did come out and visit me. And, you know, if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have been. I would have been in the competition. I would have said no. I turned it down.
What did you learn during it? It was very interesting watching you during the competition because it was actually the first time that I'd really gotten personally interested. Because do you remember what you made at the
Every single one.
Do you remember the very first thing?
Yes, out on the lake.
Tell me what you made at the lake. This is a lake out in the middle of nowhere. I don't even remember the name of the location. It was a two-hour drive from where we were all living, and it was this lake out in the middle of a park.
Yeah,
what did you make?
We had these baby
fire.
We had make fire. And Robert Irvine stole all the kindling.
Yeah, he did.
So,
which I didn't know, by the way.
He stole the kindling. So we had to make fire. So I took all my rags, soaked them in olive oil because I know that's a good secret that pizza oilers make. And I made a fire, and I believe the food was these 75-pound. Were they lambs? Pigs? What are they? Pigs?
Pigs.
Pigs or lamb?
Pigs.
Pigs. So I made a roasted pork leg with chimichurri, pistachio chimichurri. Then we made the pickled tongue and an artichoke barigoule.
The barigoule.
And
a barigoule is?
It's a barigoule is a French term for basically it's an artichoke stew with carrots, white wine, artichokes. And basically that was all we had. We had like a small pantry in the middle of nowhere. So we made
very little.
And I think we actually won that day. And that was the first day. And I was like, if the rest of the competition is this rigorous, I don't know if I can make it because people ask me how hard it was. I'm like, forget cooking. It was physically.
Oh.
It's a physical challenge.
Because it got hot. It was uncomfortable. Everything's low. You got to make fire.
And once you make fire, if there's wind, it blows in your face.
You can't control temperature.
So I don't know what the next one was, the ballpark or whatever it was. I mean,
it almost didn't matter at that point.
It didn't matter.
But I think I know the day that you decided you had it.
When?
You decided you had it when we were – I can't even remember the name of the cooking school.
Oh, in New Jersey.
Out in New Jersey.
When I beat Ann.
And it was
– She tried to throw me down.
The day you beat Ann.
And she tried to throw me down first.
Epic television because Ann had the advantage. Tried to throw you under the bus and then you clocked her. You ate her. I mean, you drank her milk.
It was theater.
And it was beautiful. And at that moment, I really think sometime that day you went, wait a second. I can win this whole freaking thing. You like, you know why? Because you quit sweating.
I quit sweating. I did, didn't
I? At that point on, you didn't sweat anymore.
I saw a drop in my dry cleaning bill that week.
It happened. If we were to go back and look at the records, we would see a distinct change.
Oh,
but
I really
remember thinking, he's not sweating anymore.
No.
He's got this now. What's the most fun thing you're doing right now?
Every Sunday I go on board. I call the ship. I call the captain. And I call Erica, the executive chef that we trained. I'm like, wait, it's on Friday. And she said, until she gets into New York Harbor, she doesn't have cell phone reception. So on Friday afternoon, I get her email. She said, I need this. I go to the market and I get it for her.
Nice.
It's cool. It's like imagine. I'm shopping on like farm to ship.
Are you picking up anything in Bermuda?
What
do they have there? Don't say Bermuda onions because I know that's complete BS.
They have the most important thing in Bermuda is Gosling rum.
Real rum.
So when you want to have a dark and stormy, I mean, there's no place. You like Bermuda?
Very much.
It's very much your style, by the way.
Oh, Bermuda's completely my style.
It's really nice. I mean, they're behind about 20 years with food.
Well, yeah.
They just are.
Yeah, it's
just
kind of where it is.
It's not. I mean, England is caught up.
Now you're starting to think about opening a restaurant in Bermuda?
I don't know. But no, I would love to continue with Norwegian because, you know, it's like Norwegian's like Vegas in the 80s. All of the cruise lines. Remember when they had all-inclusive cruises and things like that?
Sure.
You get food. It was free, but it was like, you know.
It's like fake crap.
Now they know these people, they go to Vegas. So they want to eat at a good restaurant. They'll pay. They'll pay, by the way. They'll pay extra.
Oh, sure they will.
So, you know, we have the most expensive restaurant on the ship. You pay $49 extra to eat at my restaurant, which four courses of seafood is not even cost of what it cost. It would be $100 in New York City just to, like, if I had to charge. But people are not balking. They're like, you know, it's worth it. And that's a very big turning point because they're realizing that, like, you know what? Just because it's all inclusive, it doesn't have to be free. We'll pay for real quality. So there are buffets and things like in Vegas where you can go and eat whatever all you want. And then, but most of Vegas is really premium restaurants. I mean, we were out there for 4 days a month ago, and it's staggering the amount of good food there. I mean, staggering.
It's becoming one of the best food cities in the United
States. It's weird, right? It's like, so you get out and you get a cab and you're in a hotel casino. You're like, where am I? You're like, I'm going to go to PRC's restaurant, or we're going to go to Pierre Garnier's restaurant.
Yeah.
And you come to this restaurant and they serve this knockout 12-course meal. And you're like, this is just freaky.
I'm in Vegas. Yeah.
I'm in Vegas.
Land of the prime rib buffet.
But it's kind of wonderful. It's like this culture is created.
Except you're in Vegas.
You're in Vegas. I get it. But it's like, it's great food. So the cruise industry is very, very similar, I would say, to that.
It's your style. You like it. You like the style.
Hell yeah.
Jeffrey Zakarian, thank you. Thanks
Mr.
for being
Brown,
here.
It's a pleasure.
Pleasure was mine.
Let's get another drink.
Talking with Jeffrey Zakarian, I'm thinking a lot about soufflés. You know, soufflés are something that challenge a lot of cooks, and it's something that this guy's kind of made his career on, and I was reminded of a quote. Yeah, so many people are freaked out by soufflés, and they don't realize that they're amazingly cheap, amazingly delicious, and as long as you obey a couple of rules, I wouldn't even call them rules, let's say good practices, then as James Beard said, the only thing that will make a souffle fall is that if it knows you're afraid of it. You know, everybody thinks that they're so fragile, and actually if they're constructed correctly, like a building, they're not very fragile. And a couple of tips from Jeffrey Zakarian about souffles, and I think that he tends to prefer smaller souffles, single serving souffles, just from what I've seen of them, but because I think that they're a little more durable. But regardless of the size and style, he's got a few tips, and I agree with every one of these. You always want to position the oven rack in the bottom half of the oven, because you're depending on rising heat. Of course, you need a rising oven so that you get a lot of spring, oven spring as we call it, as that foam that you've created expands. He says always use a sheet pan and space souffle 6 inches apart and stagger them. So if you're doing individuals, you don't want them to touch closely. You always want to put them on a baking sheet. A lot of people think that it's just there. What we call a half sheet pan is only there to catch spillover. Well, the truth is it's also, because it's aluminum, it's very good at radiating heat upward in a very even way. So I found that using a half sheet pan, or you know, if you've got an oven big enough, a full sheet pan, it certainly helps to even up the overall rise of the souffle. That's just my opinion. Unless you've got the kind of oven where you can literally set the souffle right on the floor of the oven, and I've also had luck with that as well. Although figuring out the temperature to use is really dependent upon that particular oven. Chef Zakarian and I both prefer room temperature egg whites. I prefer to whip egg whites when they are warm. Or at least room temperature, they tend to whip faster. And a little bit, I don't know, creamier, I guess I would say. You tend to hold a little longer at medium peaks. He likes to add a little pinch of salt to them and a bit of cream of tartar to help them, he says, lift. We know that, of course, cream of tartar, tartaric acid, helps to kind of break down some of the protein matrix of the egg whites, allowing them to, or denature them rather, not break them down, denature, have them let go of each other enough so that we can kind of reorganize them into a bubble shape. So that acid helps. Some French chefs use a little bit of lemon juice or lemon bit of vinegar. That certainly helps too. And actually, Jeffrey makes reference to using a little bit of both here. He sent me an email later saying that he likes to use a balloon whip or a KitchenAid mixer, of course, because that makes things a lot faster. He always wipes down the bowl with a rag. Of course, we want the bowl to be clean. And he might rub it with a touch of white wine vinegar. There again, an acid that helps to build that foam. And needless to say, you've got to preheat your oven. Although I like to preheat my oven to within 25 degrees of the final temperature and then set it to that final temperature right before the souffle goes in. That way I know that the oven's going to be cycling up and then I'm going to have what we call that rising oven, which I think is really important. The origins of the souffle, we know that
the souffle is French. Of course, it means a little puff of air. It's a reference to the air that holds up this kind of pillow of eggy goodness. Most historians attribute the creation to Marie-Antoine Carême, who was called Antonin Carême. He was the father of what we call French grand cuisine, may have invented the souffle somewhere around 1820 and or in the 1820s. And it happened because of a jump in technology. You have to remember that up before the 19th century, ovens were hideously primitive and inaccurate. I mean, coming up with anything that had an even air, even heat flow, you just couldn't. They were mostly either charcoal fired or coal fired, which is why so many of the cooks died. You know, I mean, 40 was old age for those guys because they all had freaking black lung. But in the early 1820s, there were developments of new ovens that actually created a rising kind of column of hot air around the vessel, the actual cooking vessel, which made for much more even cooking. And that's what allowed Carême and his cronies to come up with something as refined as the souffle, which really does require a very, very even, specific kind of heat to rise and then to set. Because, of course, rising is only half of the battle. Once it's up, you got to kind of hold it up there. You got to hold it in that elevated position while the starches and proteins in there can set so that when you get it out of the oven, it doesn't immediately go bleh. But, you know, as James Beer said, it'll only fall if it knows that you're afraid of it. You know, a lot of, you know, there's kind of a popular mythology around souffles that, you know, anything that goes bang in the kitchen, you know, if you close the door hard on the oven or, you know, even jump up and down or anything can make that souffle fall. That's only if it's very badly constructed to begin with. A properly constructed souffle can survive, you know, an M80 going off next. Well, maybe not an M80, but it can suffer some pretty serious concussion before anything bad happens. Actually, I just looked it up again. Souffle means blow. So, you know, you don't want your souffle to souffle. So be careful how you build it. Do you have to have a stand mixer to make a souffle? No, of course, you know. Does it help? Yes, of course it does. But, it, you know, if I'm making a small souffle, I'm almost quicker doing it by hand with a good balloon whisk. You do need to keep all fat and especially egg yolk out of the whites. That will definitely slow down the construction of the of the foam. However, it will not completely impede it. If you've got enough horsepower, certainly something like the ProLine KitchenAid mixer, no, they don't pay me to say that, or a bigger Hobart mixer, it doesn't care if there's a little fat in there. It's going to whip that egg white anyway, so don't worry too much about that. When it comes to the actual souffle dish, I'm not super picky about brands, but there are a few things that you need to remember to look for in whatever size that you're going to use. And I tend to go with something more of a kind of a medium size, like a 2-quart is a great place to start, unless you're going to use individual small souffle cups, which you certainly can. But there's a reason for that fluted outside, that fluted exterior on a real souffle dish. That is to actually maximize or increase the overall exterior surface area, okay? If you were to stretch that all out, you'd see that there would be a much higher ratio of exterior of that vessel than interior, and that means you've got a little bit more heat absorption. The other important thing is that the bottom of the souffle dish be unglazed. That also helps for rapid absorption from the bottom of the oven. And I'll be honest, most of the great souffle dishes, they're French. There's no question about it. And you're probably going to spend somewhere from $50 to $70. I would hand wash that, certainly, if I were you. But you know what? It's going to make a really big difference in the overall quality of the souffle. And on top of that, you're usually serving it at table in that dish. So this is one of those instances where looks can also count for a little bit. Remember, we do eat with our eyes first. So why not spring for a better souffle dish if you're going to get into this part of the business? While we're on the subject of souffles and equipment, we should, of course, talk about the whole kind of cult, I guess you would say, around copper mixing bowls. Now, I've got a copper mixing bowl, but I'll be really honest with you. I don't always reach for it when I make a souffle. Now, the reason that people use them, and certainly the French espouse them, does have sound science behind it. The copper, when the egg whites are in it and you're beating them, you've got some copper, very small amounts of copper that bond to the egg whites. electrolytes, and they create kind of it's a copper salt. Long story, I won't get into it, but it creates a copper salt that changes the structure of the eggs just a bit so that they will actually coagulate at a slightly higher temperature. Okay, so that means that if you have medium peak, so you've left some flexibility in your foam, they will continue to blow up further, and therefore you might have a higher rise before they coagulate and set in place. Now, here's the deal though. If everything else is perfect, you might notice a difference that the copper bowl makes, maybe, you know, this small amount of copper being added to the situation. But the thing is, there's so many other factors that are really more important and more controllable by the cook. So, you know, the exact point at which you whip the egg whites, the amount of acid that you have in them, you know, the oven, there's so many other factors. So if you get really good with soufflés and you're like, I want that extra little edge, then you know what? Absolutely go ahead and get that copper bowl. You're going to pay for it. You know, you're going to pay a couple $100 for that bowl, minimum for decent copper. Is it a unitasker if you get it? No. You can use it as a double boiler. Copper is an amazing conductor of heat. So, for instance, you'll make some of the best French style scrambled eggs, double boiler eggs, in that copper. You're going to spend more time cleaning the gosh darn thing, because, copper stains, it gets nasty. You got to store it carefully. Matter of fact, I wouldn't even have one if I couldn't hang it off of a pot rack. But all the same, there is some validity, to bringing that copper into the egg white protein matrix. But does it really matter in the long run? No. Now, I'm not going to go and quote an entire souffle recipe for you right now. There are plenty online, and I've got a pretty decent one also that was developed for Good Eats that you can get out of the Good Eats books. I think I guess that's in the first book. I guess I ought to go look that up. But one of the things that I've been called out for quite a bit in my instructions for cheese souffle, just going through the recipes, a lot of people have wondered why I specify that the souffle dish be chilled before the mixture goes in. And that is because I want to extend essentially the cooking time. I want the thermal trip for that egg foam to be a little longer than it would be if I just put it into a room temperature dish. If I've made sure that I have medium peaks, not really stiff peaks, which is a terrible mistake because once you've whipped them stiff, they've got nowhere else to go. You've already blown your balloons as full as they can get and you're going to have failure. If you've got a good medium peak, soft peak souffle mixture, then by putting it into a cold souffle dish, I think that you do get a little bit more of a rise, a little bit more oven spring as it slowly comes up to heat. It's something that I find works for me. If you try it and it doesn't make any difference to you, okay. But for me, it definitely makes a difference in the rise. All right, last thing about souffles that I want to mention. When are they done? And, you know, you read French cookbooks, even relatively recent ones, and they use a lot of voodoo, you know, touching it here, tapping it here, blah, blah, blah. You know what? Take its temperature. If you use an instant read thermometer, digital thermometer, like a ThermoPen, and no, they don't pay me to say that. But if you use something like that, don't worry. It's not going to deflate the souffle. You're not popping a hole in a balloon. Okay. You're sticking a probe into a jillion balloons. So I wouldn't worry about that. I look for an internal temperature right down the center of the pipe at 180 to 185 degrees is when, I pull it. And I will definitely let it sit for a couple of minutes outside the oven before I spoon into that thing. So just a tip, works for me. I don't like to guess, don't like guesswork, especially when I've got a decent thermometer in the drawer. All right, food fans, that's all we've got for you today. The Alton Brown cast is going to be returning soon to Atlanta, Georgia. But it's been great being here in New York, and I want to thank Jeffrey Zakarian for spending some time with us. And thank you for calling in and for sending your questions to us through askalton@altonbrown.com. We will be back with you soon. And until then, America, please, for the love of all that is holy, cook smart.